probably here, I said. You are a surveillance ship, after all. AIs can't be insane, he said. We can only do what we're programmed to do, which is the opposite of insanity. But you'd tell me, right, if I start to sound off? The mushroom thing is a little over the top. I can sense that. I also can't help it. The mandate is very strong inside me, along with my pilot's last words. Lie low. Don't get into any fights. And wait for him. Yes. It's why I can't let you reveal me to your DDF, even if I know it would help you and your people. I simply must follow my orders. He paused. I am worried about you taking me into the air. Did my pilot mean lie low, as in stay underground? Or did he merely mean don't let yourself be seen? I'm sure he meant the second, I said. We'll just do a quick flight around the area. It will not be quick, he said. With only maneuvering thrusters, we'll fly about as fast as you can walk. Good enough for now. I engaged the acclivity ring, raising us smoothly. I pulled up the landing struts, turned us around in a slow circle, then dipped us to one side and then the other. I grinned. The controls were similar enough, and there was an energy to the responses that my Poco simply didn't have. Now, how to get out of the cavern? I tipped the acclivity ring backward on its hinges, which in turn tipped Embot's nose up. I launched the light lance, spearing it into a cracked portion of the ceiling. I pulled back, using the rotational thrusters, then lowered the power of the acclivity ring. That gave us some force, even without a booster. The light lance went taut. Dust and chips of stone streamed down from the ceiling. Doomslug mimicked the sound from behind me, fluting in an energetic, excited way. A portion of the ceiling collapsed in a shower of rock and dust. I disengaged the light lance, looking up through the hole. There was no skylight nearby, so above was a dark, uniform grayness. The sky. Can your hologram create a projection of a new roof? I asked Embot. Yes, but it will be less secure, he said. Sonar imaging can see through the hologram, but it feels like so long since I've seen the sky. He seemed wistful, though he would probably claim that was some kind of programming quirk. Let's go, I said. Come on. Let's fly. Embot said softly. Yes, all right. Let's go. I do want to fly again. Just be careful and keep me out of sight. I raised us up through the hole, then waved to Rig, who was standing with our things a short distance away. Engaging stealth mechanisms, Embot said. We should now be invisible to DDF sensors. I grinned. I was in the sky, with my own ship. I slammed the throttle forward. We stayed in place. Right. No booster. I engaged the maneuvering thrusters, which were intended more for fine-tuned positioning than they were for actual movement. And we started flying. Slowly. Yippee, Embot said. It is kind of a letdown, isn't it? Still, I did a small loop for Rig, with diagnostics running. When I completed the circle, he gave a thumbs up, then settled his pack on his shoulder and started hiking off. He had to get back to Igneous to return the sealing equipment. I couldn't quite persuade myself to land. After all this time, I wanted to fly a little longer with Embot. So I grabbed the altitude lever. The control sphere could make the ship bob up and down, powering the acclivity ring for the finer points of dodging. But if you wanted a quick ascent, this was the way. I eased it toward me. We shot upward into the sky. I hadn't expected it to work this well. We rocketed upward, and I felt G-forces slam into me, forcing me down. I cringed, noticing how fast we were going, and eased off the lever. That kind of G-force would crush me? I felt the acceleration, but not nearly as much as I should have. I couldn't be pulling more than 3 Gs, though I felt like it should have been much more. What are you doing? I asked. Can you be more specific? I have over 170 semi-autonomous subroutines that the G-forces, I said, looking out the window, watching the ground retreat at an alarming pace. I should be blacking out about now. Oh, yes, that. My gravitational capacitors are capable of belaying 60% of G-forces, with a maximum threshold of well over 100 Earth standard. I did warn you that your ships had primitive systems for handling pilot stress. I let off on the altitude lever, and the ship stopped accelerating. Would you like to engage rotational G-force management for further help withstanding the forces? M'Bot asked. Like where my seat turns around? I asked, remembering what Rig had explained about M'Bot. Humans didn't do well with G-forces in the wrong directions. It was much harder for us to take downward forces, for example, because they pushed all the blood in our bodies into our feet. M'Bot could compensate for that by rotating the seat, so that I took the forces backward, in a way easier for my body to handle. Not for now, I said. Let me first get used to how you fly.
Very well,
M'Bot said. We quickly reached 100,000 feet, which was around the highest that we flew DDF ships in regular situations. I reached to decelerate, but hesitated. Why not go a little higher? I'd always wanted to. Now nobody was there to stop me. I kept us going, soaring upward until the altitude indicator hit 500,000 feet. There, finally, I slowed us, admiring the view. I'd never been so high. The mountain peaks below looked like nothing more than crumpled up paper. I could actually see the planet curving, and not merely some faint arc either. I felt as if I could stretch onto my toes and see the whole planet. I was still barely halfway to the rubble belt, which I'd been told was in low orbit starting at around 1,000,000 feet. However, from this height, I could see it far better. What I saw from the surface as only vague patterns now manifested as enormous swaths of metal upon metal, vaguely lit by some sources I couldn't make out. Looking at it, realizing it was still well over 100 kilometers away, the grand scale of it finally started to strike me. Those little specks that looked like individual dots, those had to be as large as the piece of debris that had crashed down during that fight a week back. It was all so enormous. My jaw dropped as I gazed at it, taking in the many sections, all rotating and churning in esoteric orbits. Mostly just shadows, moving, swirling, layers upon layers.
Would you like to get closer?
M'Bot said. I don't dare. They said that some of the junk would shoot at me.
Well, those are obvious remnants of a semi-autonomous defense grid, he said. With the shadows of outer habitat platforms behind, I'd say, all interspersed with broken shipyards and matter reclamation drones.
I watched it shifting, moving, and tried to imagine a time when this had been functional, used, lived in, a world above the world.
Yes, some of those defense platforms are clearly operational,
M'Bot said.
Even I would have difficulty slipping past them. Note those asteroids I'm highlighting on your canopy. Slag formations on the surface indicate their ancient purpose. Some strategies for suppressing a planet include towing interplanetary bodies into position and dropping them. This can accomplish anything from the removal of a specific city to an extinction-level disaster.
I breathed out softly, horrified to imagine it.
Not that I was originally a combat ship, mind you,
M'Bot said.
I don't know about orbital bombardment from my own programming. I suppose somebody must have told it to me once.
I thought you didn't lie.
I don't. I genuinely believe that I'm an advanced, well-armed, stealth-capable ship because it will help me harvest fungi better. That is not at all irrational.
So all the Krell really would need to do to deal with us, I said, is shove some of these asteroids down?
It's a little harder than you make it sound,
M'Bot said.
The Krell would need a ship large enough to move something of such a sizable mass. That would likely require a capital ship, which those defense platforms would probably be able to shoot down with ease. Small ships could get through some of those gaps, though. which I guess you already know, considering how often you fight them. I settled back in the seat, letting myself enjoy the view. The expansive world below, the sky that somehow felt smaller than it once had. It was only a narrow band around the planet, capped by the rubble belt. I stared upward for a time, admiring the grand motions of the rubble belt, the enormous shells and platforms, moving according to their ancient and esoteric design. There must have been dozens of layers, but in that moment, for only the second time in my life, it all aligned. And I saw out into space, true infinity, broken by a few twinkling stars, which I swore I could hear. Whispers. No distinct words, but something real. Gran-Gran was right. If I listened, I could hear the stars. They sounded like the horns of battle, calling out, drawing me toward them. Don't be a fool, I thought. You don't have a booster. If the Krell find you, you'll be little more than target practice. Reluctantly, I began to ease us downward. That was probably enough for one day. We descended slowly, letting gravity do most of the work. Unfortunately, we'd drifted some distance in the wind, so when we landed, I had to inch us, with those tiny maneuvering thrusters, back toward the hole. It took long enough that by the time we got there, I was yawning. Doomslug imitated the sound of my yawn from where she'd settled down into the blanket behind my seat. Finally, we lowered into the cavern and landed near Embot's original resting spot. Well, I'd call that a great first run, I said.
Yes,
Embot said. We went very high, didn't we? If I can only figure out a way to get a booster, we'll have you flying for real in no time.
You could try fighting the Krell if you wanted, I said, testing whether I could push him further.
We could do that while lying low. We just wouldn't tell anyone what or who we are. The black phantom ship with no call sign, flying in to help the DDF in times of need.
I don't think.
Imagine it, Embot. Dodging and swooping amid exploding barrages. Soaring and striving. Proving yourself stronger than your enemies. A grand symphony of destruction and power.
Or, even better, sitting in the cave, doing none of that.
We could fight with stealth mode on, I said.
That is still the opposite of lying low. I'm sorry, Spencer. I must not fight. We can fly again. I kind of liked it. But we cannot ever fight.
Ever fight, Doomslug added.
I turned off the ship's non-essentials, then leaned back my seat. Feeling sick. I had access to something awesome, something powerful, something amazing, but I couldn't use it. I had a weapon that didn't want me to swing it. What should I do? I didn't know, but I found it most disturbing that my ship was, well, a coward. I sighed and started getting ready for bed. My frustration with Embot faded. I was too excited by the fact that I'd actually gotten him into the air. As I finally settled down, seat reclined, blanket pulled around me, Doomslug moved to a fold-out shelf in the canopy. Embot spoke again softly.
Spencer, he said, you don't mind, do you, staying out of combat? I have to obey my orders.
No, you don't.
I'm a computer. That's basically all I do. I literally can't even count to zero without an order.
I find that hard to believe, I said, considering the things you've said to me.
That's a personality programmed to interact with humans.
Excuses, I said, yawning, dimming the lights. You might have a machine mind, but you're still a person.
But
I can hear you, I said, yawning. I can hear your soul, like the stars. It was a faint hum in the back of my mind, and I hadn't noticed it until right then. But it was there. Whatever he thought, Embot was more alive than he gave himself credit for being. I could simply feel it. I started to drift off. He spoke again, his voice even quieter.
The orders are the only thing I know for sure, Spencer. My old pilot, my purpose. That's who I was.
Become someone new then.
Do you have any idea how hard that is?
I thought about my own cowardice, the feelings of loss and of inadequacy, now that I actually had to do the things I'd always bragged that I would do. I pulled my blanket close. Don't be silly, I said. Why would I ever want to be anyone else? He didn't respond, and eventually, I drifted off to sleep. Chapter 31. My flight with Embot, though brief and mostly linear, still managed to overshadow the next 2 weeks of simulation training. I performed a maneuver, chasing a Krell ship through a series of tight turns around chunks of debris hurl on my wing, but my mind started to drift. The Krell ship got away.
Hey, Kimmelin said as we regrouped. Did you guys see? I didn't crash!
I listened with half an ear, still distracted, as they all chattered.
I crashed, though, FM admitted. I hit a piece of debris and went down in a fiery heap. Not your fault, Kimmelin said. As the saint always said, true failure is choosing to fail.
Besides, FM, Arturo added, you've still crashed fewer times than the rest of us, total.
I won't hold that record for long if I keep this up, FM said.
You're just trying to be subversive by crashing today, Hurl said, because nobody expects it from you. You rebel, you.
FM chuckled softly.
You could all do what nobody expects, Jorgen said on the group line, and actually line up straight for once. Amphi, I'm looking at you.
Right, right,
Arturo said, hovering his ship into place.
Though I guess technically Jorgen has crashed less than you, FM. He's flown half as often. It's hard to blow up when all you do is sit around complaining and giving orders.
As the saint always said, Kimmelin added again in a solemn voice, true failure is choosing to fail.
Jorgen didn't defend himself, though I thought I heard a quick intake of breath from him. I grimaced. It was true that Jorgen tended to hang back and watch us run exercises, offering instruction rather than flying himself. But maybe the others would act differently if they knew he spent late nights practicing on his own afterward. I felt ashamed, suddenly. Jorgen's call sign and the way the others treated him were partially my fault. He didn't deserve all that. I mean, he could be insufferable, but he was trying to do his best. As Cobb sent us in for another round of dogfighting, Riggs' words floated up from the back of my mind. What about me? Am I a coward, Spencer? I was certain he wasn't. But I'd lived my childhood clinging to a simple rule reinforced by Grand stories. Good people were brave. Bad people were cowards. I knew my father had been a good person, so it was obvious to me that he couldn't have run away. End of story. Close the book. It was getting harder to hold that particular black and white line. I'd promised Hurl I wouldn't be a coward. But did any coward intend to turn and run? I'd never felt like fleeing a battle, but I was still surprised by the real emotions of being a pilot. By how much it had hurt to lose Bim and Morningtide. By how overwhelmed I sometimes felt. Was it possible that something similar, for a brief moment, had caused my father to retreat? And if he had, could I really promise that I wouldn't someday do the same? I dodged around a chunk of debris, but almost clipped Hurl's wing.
Come on, spin, she said. Head in the game, eye on the ball.
The ball?
Sorry, league metaphor.
I didn't get to go to many games. Workers got tickets as rewards for exemplary merits. But it would be good to talk about something to get my thoughts off my worries. I barely know what you did. Something about hover bikes? Did you fly?
Not quite. Hurl said as we dodged back and forth, a Krell ship, as per the exercise, coming in behind us. The Digball League gets acclivity rings that are too small to fly ships. Our bikes could go full 3D in little bursts, but each bike is allotted a fixed amount of airtime. Part of the strategy is knowing when to use it.
She sounded wistful. Do you miss the game? I asked.
A little. Mostly my team. This is way better, though.
A flash of destructor fire sprayed around us.
More dangerous, more of a rush.
We did a wave dodge, where we split in opposite directions under heavy destructor fire. Hurl stayed on our target while I looped back down and offered fire support, chasing off the enemy. I caught up at the next turn, falling in behind Hurl. Our target flew extra low, only 100 feet or so off the ground. We descended, tossing up plumes of blue-gray dust behind us, and darted past an ancient piece of debris. Long since scavenged for its acclivity stone, it lay exposed like the skeleton of a disturbed grave. "So," Hurl said as we flew through valleys, staying on our target.
"What about you? You never talk about what you used to do before the DDF.
Aren't we supposed to keep our head in the game?"
"Eh, except when I'm curious."
I was a rat catcher.
Like, for one of the protein factories?
No, I was solo. The factory scouts hunt the lower caverns out pretty well, so I built my own spear gun, explored farther caverns, and caught them on my own. My mom sold the meat for requisition chits to workers on their way home.
"Wow, that's badass."
"You think so?"
"Totally."
I smiled, feeling warm at that. The Krell turned and accelerated upward. "I'm going in," I said, and hit my overburn. I raced up at an angle, my G-force line going to max. "Tonight," I thought to the Krell, "your ashen remains will mix with the planet's dust, and your howls of pain shall echo upon the wind." I cut into the ship's wake, getting just close enough to hit my IMP and destroy its shield. Hurl flew past me, her destructor fire sounding over the blaring klaxon that warned my shield was down. The Krell ship exploded into molten debris. Hurl let out a whoop, but then I blushed, remembering my line of thought. Ashes mixing with dust and howls on the wind? That sort of thing, once so exciting to me, now seemed less the words of a hero and more the words of someone trying to sound heroic. My father had never talked like that. As I reignited my shield, a light on the communication panel lit up, announcing that Cobb was listening in.
"Nice work," he said. "You two are starting to make a good team."
"Thanks, Cobb," I said.
"It would be better if Spin could spend time with the rest of us," Pearl added. "You know, instead of sleeping in her cave." "Let me know when you intend to take that up with the Admiral," Cobb said. "I'll be sure to leave the building so I don't have to listen to her shout at you. Cobb out."
The light went off, and Hurl hovered her ship down beside mine.
"The way she treats you is stupid, Spin. You are a badass. Like that stuff you always say."
"Thanks," I answered. I could feel my cheeks heating up. Those things make me feel self-conscious now, though.
"Don't let them get to you, Spin. Be who you are."
And who am I? I looked upward, wondering if the simulation ever created holes in the debris, if it ever let you see through to the highest sky. We ran a few more exercises before Jorgen called us back in to line up. We hovered in place, and I checked the clock on my dash. Only 1600? We still had several hours of training left. Was Cobb going to call it early and send us for more centrifuge time, like he'd done yesterday?
"All right," Cobb announced over the radio. "You're ready for the next lesson."
"We get to use destructors?" Kimmelin exclaimed. I leaned forward in my seat to look out at her cockpit. We'd been fighting with destructors for weeks now.
"Sorry," she said. "Got caught up in the hype."
A Krell bomber materialized in front of us. It was a sturdier build than the average Krell ship. It was the same shape, but in the center between its wings, it carried an enormous life buster. The bomb was even bigger than the ship was. I shivered, remembering the last time I'd seen one of these, when Bim and I had chased one down. A scene materialized farther out, a mess of fighting ships, some Krell, some DDF.
"Our AA guns cover a range out to 120 clicks from Alta," Cobb said. "The guns need to be big enough to blast Krell ships through their shields. Not to mention big enough to shoot apart large debris so it burns up while falling. But being so big limits their functional arc. They're really good at picking off distant objects, but can't hit things too close. If Krell get low enough, about 600 feet from the ground, they can come in under the big guns. The smaller gun emplacements, like the ones Quirk trained on before, don't have the punch to get through Krell shields. Without fighters IMPing the enemy, the small gun emplacements have trouble.
The simulation highlighted a specific ship among the ones fighting in the distance. Another bomber.
The Krell distract us with dogfights and falling debris, then often try to sneak through a bomber carrying a lifebuster,
Cobb continued.
You need to be constantly aware and watching to report sighting a lifebuster. And I'll warn you, they've used decoys before.
We report it, Hurl said, and then we shoot it, right? Or maybe better, shoot it first, then report?
Do that, Cobb said, and it could be disastrous. Lifebusters are often rigged to explode if damaged. Shoot one of these down at the wrong time, and you could get dozens of your companion pilots killed.
Oh, Hurl said.
Only the Admiral, or acting command staff, can authorize shooting down a lifebuster,
Cobb continued.
Often we can chase the bomber away by threatening it. Lifebusters are valuable, and as far as we can surmise, difficult to produce. If that doesn't work, the Admiral will send in a special strike team to shoot down the bomber. Be extremely careful. Igneous is far enough below the surface that only a direct hit right on top will send a blast down deep enough to harm it. But casually destroying a lifebuster too close, even 40 or 50 clicks away, could destroy Alta in the corrosion wave the bomb releases. So if you spot a bomber, you call it in immediately. Then let someone with the experience, data, and authority decide what to do. Understood?
Scattered mumbles of understood followed. Then Jorgen made us all sound off one at a time, giving a verbal acknowledgement. Maybe we did treat him a little too harshly, but Scud, he could be annoying.
Great,
Cobb said.
Flight leader, scramble your people through this battlefield. We'll do some scenarios where we practice spotting, reporting, and, yes, taking down lifebusters. Any guesses how often you will all blow yourselves up?
Turned out, we blew ourselves up a lot. The lifebuster drills were among the most difficult we'd ever done. In our first days flying, we'd learned to do what was called a pilot scan, a quick assessment of all the things we needed to keep in mind while flying. Booster indicators, navigation instruments, altitude, communication channels, wing mates, flight mates, terrain, and a dozen more. Going into battle added a host of other things to watch. Orders from the flight leader or from Alta, tactics, enemies. A pilot's situational awareness was one of the most mentally taxing parts of the job. Doing all of that while constantly watching for a bomber, well, it was tough. Extremely tough. Sometimes Cobb would run us through entire hour-long battle simulations and never send in a bomber. Sometime he'd send in 7, 6 decoys and a real one. The bombers were remarkably slow. They maxed out at Mach 2, but carried a deadly payload. When a bomb went off, it hit with 3 waves. The first explosion was meant to blast downward, penetrating rock, collapsing or ripping open caverns. After that was a second explosion. It was a strange, greenish-black color. This alien corrosion could exterminate life, causing a chain reaction in organic matter. The third explosion was a shockwave, meant to drive this terrible, burning green light outward. We ran simulation after simulation. Time and time again, one of us blew the bomb up too soon without giving warning for the others to overburn away, which vaporized our entire flight. Multiple times we misjudged how close we'd gotten to Alta, so that when we destroyed the bomber and detonated the bomb, Cobb sent the grim report.
You just killed the entire population of Alta. I'm dead now. Congratulations.
After one particularly frustrating run, the 6 of us pulled up together and watched the sickly green light expand.
I'm...
Cobb began.
You're dead, FM said. We get it, Cobb. What are we supposed to do?
If the bomb gets too close to the city, do we have any other choice?
No,
Cobb said softly.
You don't.
But
if it comes down to destroying Alta, but saving Igneous,
Cobb said,
Igneous is more important. There's a reason we rotate a third of our ships, pilots, and command staff into the deep caverns. The DDF can survive, maybe, if Alta is destroyed. But without the apparatus to make new ships, we're done for. So if the Admiral orders it, you shoot that bomb and make it detonate, even if doing so destroys Alta.
We watched the green light crawling through an ever-widening sphere of destruction. Finally, it faded. Cobb made us fly exercises until I was numb from exhaustion, my reaction time slowing. Then he made us do it again. He wanted to drill deeply into us to always watch for bombers, no matter how tired we were. During that last run, I hated Cobb like I'd never hated anyone, even more than the Admiral. We failed to stop the bomb this time, too. I reset my position, falling into line by rote to start the next run. However, my canopy vanished. I blinked, surprised to be back in the real world. The others began pulling off helmets and standing up to stretch. What time was it?
Did I recognize that last battle, Cobb? Arturo asked, standing up. Was it the Battle of Traherto? With modifications, Cobb said.
Traherto, I thought. It had happened about 5 years ago. We'd come very close to losing Alta. A Krell flight had snuck in and destroyed the smaller AA guns. Fortunately, a couple of DDF scout ships had brought down the lifebuster before it could get close enough to Alta. You're using historical battles for our simulations? I asked, trying to push through my stupor.
Of course I am, Cobb said. You think I have time to make up these simulations?
Something about that struck me, but I was too exhausted to put my finger on it. I climbed out of my mockpit, tossed my helmet onto my seat, and stretched. Scud, I was hungry. But I didn't have any dinner with me. The next batch of jerky was curing back at my cave. I had a long, tired, hungry walk ahead of me. I grabbed my pack, slung it over my shoulder, and started out. Hurl caught up to me in the hallway, then nodded in the direction of the nearby dorm section. I could read her expression. They could pretend to be tired, bring food back to their rooms. I shook my head. It wasn't worth riling the Admiral. Hurl gave me a raised fist.
Badass, she whispered.
I found energy for a smile, raised my own, then we parted. I trudged toward the exit. The other classrooms were dark, save one, where the instructor was lecturing another flight of cadets.
The best pilots can steer a ship out of an uncontrolled fall, a woman's voice said, echoing in the hallway. Your first reaction might be to eject, but if you want to be a real hero, you will do whatever you can to save your acclivity ring. A defiant protects the people, not the self.
It was basically the opposite of what Cobb had taught us. On my way through the orchard outside the base, I noticed my radio blinking. Embot wanted to talk with me. I had persuaded him, with effort, to stop breaking into my line while I was training. It just seemed too likely that someone would overhear us. Hey, I said into the line, bored?
I can't get bored. He paused. But I'll have you know that I can think at thousands of times the speed of a human brain. So 12 hours to you is, by relative measure, a long time to me. A really long time.
I smiled.
Really long, he added.
What did you think of the training today?
I took some careful notes for further review, he said.
Most nights, I went over with Embot what I'd done wrong. His programs offered excellent analysis of my flying. While he offered commentary that could sometimes be unflattering, the nightly debriefings had proved effective in helping me tweak my flying, and I felt I was doing better than ever. We hadn't gone into the air again. Rig had taken out the ship's grav caps and shields to disassemble and document them. It was work beyond my ability to help with, but I didn't mind, as I had the practices to keep me busy.
You really do need help against bombers,
Embot said to me.
You died or destroyed the city 17 times today, while you were completely successful only twice.
Thanks for the reminder.
I tried to be helpful. I realize human memories are flawed and inconsistent.
I sighed and walked out of the orchard, starting the more boring part of the trek home.
The battles were interesting,
Embot said.
I'm very glad that you lived through some of them.
One foot after the other. Who would have thought that sitting in a box, moving only your hands, could be so tiring? My brain felt like it had been ripped out, clubbed to death by a barbarian, then stuffed back in upside down.
You are very attractive and intelligent,
Embot said.
Spensa, is my moral support subroutine functioning? You're quite bipedal and very efficient at converting oxygen into carbon dioxide, an essential gas for plant life to-
I'm just tired, Embot. I've been through a lot today.
19 battles, though 4 of them were the same battle, turned on a different axis, and presented with a few distinct movement seeds for enemies.
Yeah, those are historical fights, I said. Like Cobb said, I halted.
Spensa?
He asked.
I hear no more footfalls. Have you temporarily stopped being bipedal?
Historical battles, I said, realizing something I should have put together long ago. They have recordings of past battles?
They track all of their ships, he said, and have scanner records of enemy movements. I suspect they recreate these three-dimensional models for training and analysis.
Do you suppose they have a record like that of the Battle of Alta? The fight where my father had deserted?
I'm sure they do somewhere,
Embot continued.
It's the most important battle in the history of your people. The foundation of, oh, your father.
You can think at 1,000 times the speed of a human brain, I said. But it took you that long to put together a simple fact?
I underclock conversations. If I focus my full efforts, it takes you several minutes in relative time to speak a single syllable.
I suppose that made sense. The record of my father's battle, can you grab it? Show it to me?
I can only intercept what they're actively broadcasting,
he said.
It seems that the DDF tries to minimize wireless communication so as to not attract the attention of the eyes.
The what? I asked.
The eyes. I have no idea what that is. There's a hole in my memory banks there.
Huh. The ship sounded genuinely confused.
I remember this quote. Use physical cords for data transfer, avoid broadcasting, and put shielding around faster processors. To do otherwise risks the attention of the eyes. But that's it. Curious.
So maybe our communications aren't as primitive as you always say. Maybe they're just being careful. I started walking again. My pack felt so heavy, it could have been filled with spent shell casings.
Either way, Embot said. I would guess there's an archive somewhere on base. If they have a recording of the Battle of Alta, that would be the first place to check.
I nodded. I wasn't sure whether to feel excited or further bowed down by the knowledge that I could theoretically watch my father's last battle. See for myself if he'd actually deserted and have, what, proof? I trudged onward, trying to decide if I was hungry enough to eat when I got to the cave, or if I was just going to collapse. As I neared the cavern, I saw the light flashing on my radio again. I lifted it to my head. I'm almost back, Embot. You can-
General, call to arms, an operator said. The Admiral has called all pilots, cadets included, to base for possible deployment. Repeat. A 75-ship Krell invasion has breached the debris field at 104.2-803-64,000. All active pilots are instructed to assemble for a general call to arms. The Admiral has called all pilots.
I froze. I'd almost forgotten the original reason Cobb had given me a radio. But today, of all days, I could barely walk. 75 ships? 3/4 of the Krell maximum flight capacity?
Scud!
I pivoted, looking at the long hike back to Alta. Then, lethargically, I pushed myself into a jog. Chapter 32. I reached the DDF compound a sweaty, out-of-breath mess. Fortunately, my daily walks back and forth to my cave had been a good imitation of physical training, so I was in reasonable shape. The gate guards waved me through, and I forced myself into another jog. I stopped off at the changing rooms near the launch pad and threw on my flight suit. I bolted out the door, running for my ship. My Poco sat alone. Ned's ship had long since been assigned to another flight, and everyone else would be in the air already. The faint sound of AA guns popped in the distance, and burning streaks of falling debris indicated that this battlefield was dangerously close to Alta's defensive perimeter. My fatigue was suddenly overpowered by a spike of concern. A pilot was climbing into the cockpit of my ship. "Wait," I shouted. "What are you doing? That's my ship." The pilot hesitated, glancing down at the ground crew who had been prepping the ship. One of them nodded. The pilot climbed slowly back down the ladder.
"You're late,"
Dorgo, a man from the ground crew, said to me.
"The Admiral ordered all unoccupied ships manned and sent in as reserves."
My heart thundered inside my chest as the woman, reluctantly, hopped down and pulled off her helmet. She was in her early 20s and bore a prominent scar across her forehead. She gave me a thumbs up, but said nothing else as she trudged off toward the crew quarters. "Who's that?" I asked softly.
"Call sign Vigor," Dorgo said. "Former cadet who got shot down just before graduating. She was good enough that the Admiral added her to the reserve roster."
"She ejected?" I asked. Dorgo nodded. I climbed up the ladder, then took my helmet from Dorgo, who climbed up after me.
"Head to 110-75-1800, he said, pointing toward the battlefield. "Unless you hear otherwise. That's where your flight was told to hold position. All at flight command know you're up and off."
"Thanks," I said, pulling on the helmet, then strapping in. He gave me a thumbs up, then climbed down and pulled back the ladder. Another ground crew member waved with a blue flag once everyone was safely away. I turned on the acclivity ring, then raised my ship. 1800 was a low altitude for fighting. We usually trained somewhere around 30,000. I felt like I was skimming the ground as I darted in the indicated direction.
"Skyward 10, I said, pressing the button to call Jorgen. "Reporting in. Call sign spin." "You made it?"
Jorgen replied.
"They said they were going to send us a reservist."
"It was a tight call," I said, "but I convinced them I was the only one capable of giving you enough crap." "You fighting?"
"No," he said. "The Admiral has us holding position near one of the AA guns. 110-75-1800 spin. Glad to have you. Crap and all."
It took me around 10 minutes to reach the position, where I spotted the other 5 members of my flight hovering between 2 large hills. I decelerated with a reverse burn, then fell into wingmate position by hurl. Behind us, an enormous AA gun, longer than the flight school building and then some, scanned the air for incoming Krell. A series of smaller guns sprouted from the base, ready to fire on low-flying ships. A round of greetings from the others welcomed me. I could barely make out some flashes in the sky to mark the battlefield. The AA gun, however, let out a roaring blast behind us, shaking my Poco. Far overhead, a larger chunk of debris exploded into a shower of sparks and dust.
"So," Hurl said in my ear, "how many kills you going to get today, Spin?"
"Well, the record in a single battle is held by callsign Dodger. 12 direct kills, 9 assists. I figure it would be arrogant to try to beat that. So I'll go for the tie." I expected a chuckle, but Hurl seemed serious when she said,
12-9? That doesn't sound like so many."
"Considering that most Krell incursion forces are around 30 ships?"
"There are 75 today," Hurl said. "Easy pickings, if the DDF would let us actually fight."
She inched her Poco forward with maneuvering thrusters, and I followed.
"Where do you two think you're going?"
Jorgen asked. Just trying to get a better view of the battlefield, I said.
Yeah, belay that. Back into formation. Our orders are to hold position.
We obeyed, but I found myself itching to get on with the battle. Sitting and waiting there, my fatigue kept bringing itself to my attention. Let's call Cobb, I said. See if maybe we should send a pair of fighters out to scout the area.
I'm sure they have scouts working the field, Jorgen said. Hold position, Spin.
Hey, Arturo, FM said over the line. How far away is the main battle, do you suppose?
You're asking me? He replied.
You're the smart one. There was silence on the line for a moment. Well? FM asked.
Oh, Arturo said. Sorry, I was just, well, waiting for Ned to make a wisecrack. I guess that's still my instinct. Here, I can calculate the distance for you exactly.
A light flashed on our comm console.
Hey, Cobb, how far away is that fight?
About 50 clicks, Cobb said. Stay put, cadets. Victory Flight is almost up from the caverns, and they'll relieve you once they come in.
His light flipped off. Great calculations there, Amphi, FM said to Arturo.
I consider it a mark of true intelligence to realize when someone else has already done your work for you, he said. That would make a good saying, right, Quirk? Will you use that one sometime?
Bless your stars.
This isn't fair, Pearl said. We should be fighting. We're hardly cadets anymore, and I'm tired of simulations. Right, Spin?
Off in the distance, flashes of light marked where men and women were dying. Losing friends, like I had. I hated that this creeping, insidious worry had somehow infiltrated my heart. This hesitance, this fear. It was stronger today, probably because I was tired. Maybe if I could get out into the fight, I could prove myself to myself. Yeah, Pearl's right, I answered. We should be killing Krell, not killing time.
We do as we're ordered, Jorgen said, and we don't debate with our commanders. I find it remarkable how you can claim to hardly be cadets anymore when you have yet to grasp something so fundamental as command structure.
I bit my lip, then felt my face go warm with embarrassment. He was right, stupid jerk face. I forced myself to wait for our replacements. They'd be one of the reserve flights, hangared, starfighters and all, down in the deep caverns. It was a careful balance. We couldn't risk a blast wiping out the entire DDF by destroying Alta, but any ships we didn't keep on immediate call took time to retrieve via the vehicle elevators. Eventually, Cobb's line flashed back on. I stifled a sigh. Truth be told, we weren't in any shape to fight today, not after that long spent training. I prepared myself to turn and go back.
Krell Squadron, Cobb said. 8 ships.
What?
At heading 125-111-1000,
Cobb continued.
One of our scouting pairs caught them sneaking in at low altitude. Flight leader, your backup is still 5 to 10 away. You'll need to engage.
Engage?
Understood, Flight Command, Jorgen said. These are standard Krell interceptors. Best the scouts could tell, Cobb said. Admiral's orders are for you to get close, visually confirm that there isn't a bomber among them, then destroy or drive back any fighters. AA guns will wait on standby. Shooting into combat is a good way to get our own people killed. But if you can IMP any fighters that escape you, the small AA guns should be able to handle them. And if you can lure any enemy high enough, the large gun might be able to pick them off.
Cobb paused.
I'm patching your ships into the general battle chatter. Good luck, cadets. Listen to your flight leader. Remember your training. This one is for real.
The light clicked off.
Finally, Pearl said.
I want a wide sweep formation, Jorgen said to us. You heard the heading. 125-111-1000. This is going to be close to the ground. Watch your relative elevation. Let's move.
We fell into a wide formation in wingmate pairs. Me and Hurl, Jorgen and Arturo, FM and Kimmelin.
We sped through the gap between the two peaks, rounding to the east, along the indicated heading. We caught the visuals almost immediately. 8 Krell ships flying in a U-shape.
"We're yours, Flight Leader,"
a woman's voice said on the general channel.
"Val Class, Ranger 7, call sign Cloak."
"Ranger 8, call sign Underscore,"
a male voice added. Val Class. Those would be the 2 scout ships. I couldn't pick them out yet, but they'd join the fight with us. My fatigue melted away in the face of my excitement. It was happening. A real fight. Not an accidental engagement, but actual orders to bring down an enemy squadron.
"Thanks for your help, scouts,"
Jorgen said.
"We're ordered to get visual confirmation on the status of a bomber among these fellows. Ranger Pair, I want you to coordinate that to Flight Command. My POCOs will run a scatter formation and try to break the enemy apart into individuals. Focus your attention on making sure we've identified each ship."
"Confirmed,"
Cloak said.
"All right, team,"
Jorgen said.
"Overburn to Mag 3. And once we engage, drop to dogfighting speeds. Free for all, take what you can, and watch your wingmate."
He breathed out.
"Stars guard you."
"And you, Flight Leader," Arturo said.
They both sounded worried. My resolve wavered, which I hated. I was not going to become a coward.
"Go,"
Jorgen said.
"Yeah!"
Pearl yelped and hit her overburn. I followed, tearing through the sky in a sudden acceleration toward the enemy. Exactly as in the simulations, the Krell scattered when directly engaged. They didn't worry about covering their wingmates. They counted on their superior ships to compensate for our superior coordination. I hugged Hurl's left rear. We pulled out of overburn at high speed and banked right, picking a specific Krell ship to target. We'd moved into a debris fall, but it was mostly small chunks that were burning up high overhead. The occasional mid-sized piece dropped past us, trailing smoke, but none were big enough for light lance maneuvers. We fell to fighting speeds and stuck to our target. I held back just far enough to be outside range if Hurl fired her IMP. 2 Val-class starfighters, designed for scanner avoidance and speed, swooped in overhead. They wouldn't have much in the way of firepower. "Cloak," I said, flipping a button. "This is Skyward 10, call sign Spin. The ship I'm chasing is a regular Krell interceptor."
"Confirmed,"
Cloak said. I didn't hear the rest of the chatter. The others would be reporting individually. Hopefully, the 2 scouts could keep track enough to identify each ship. Hurl and I swept along the ground, dodging right, then left, as we passed into a large crater. Hurl hit overburn to try to get close enough to IMP, but overshot as the Krell turned upward. I stayed on it, and Hurl cursed softly, falling in behind me.
"We don't have any tailspin. Let's bring that bucket down before it gets help."
"Confirmed."
I kept my attention on the enemy. Yes, single-minded focus. My helmet sensors, which I mostly ignored these days, grew warm. I felt like I could anticipate the Krell's turns as it zipped out of the crater and banked right. Focus. Nothing else mattered. No worries. No fear. Just me, my ship, and the target. Closer. Closer. Almost.
"Guys, help!"
Kimmelin. I cursed, my concentration breaking. There she was, being chased by 3 tails. Scud! FM curved around behind, trying to get into position to offer her support. I broke off my chase, and Hurl followed as we rushed toward Kimmelin.
"Covering fire," I said.
And the 2 of us opened up with destructors, spraying enough fire that the 3 tails went into defensive maneuvers and let Kimmelin escape.
"Thanks,"
FM said, falling in beside Kimmelin. I took the time to spot Arturo and Jorgen engaged in a dogfight with 3 Krell. With that much heat on them, they wouldn't dare use an IMP and leave themselves exposed.
"We need to pick off some strays," I said to Hurl, "and bring the odds in our favor."
"Right," she said. "At your 3. Look good?"
"Go for it," I said,
following her as we swooped toward another Krell. It looked identical to the one we'd been chasing, that same shape with wires trailing at the rear. It didn't appear that any of these were bombers.
I radioed in what we'd seen, and then we chased the ship out away from the main firefight. When it tried to cut left to circle around, I was able to overburn and drive it back. Isolated, it tried to simply outrun us on the straight, accelerating to Mag 3, then Mag 4.
"I'm going in," Hurl said.
Her booster flared into overburn, and she roared forward. I was already anticipating her. We'd done this together so many times in the last week that I knew, by instinct, exactly how it would go. In a perfect maneuver, she got in just close enough and hit her IMP. With a flash of blue, her shield went down, and so did the Krell's. I weaved past as she slowed, then I unleashed my destructors. It was almost a surprise when the Krell ship exploded into molten bits. It had actually worked. Pearl whooped as we both slowed down. I pivoted and came back to cover her while she reignited her shield. A piece of space debris careened past me, exploding with a soft blast when it impacted not far below.
"Is that first blood?" I said, hitting a button. "Jorgen, we got one!"
"Congrats," he said, his voice tense.
I scanned the rest of the battle. He and Arturo were still dealing with three ships, and the scouts had managed to chase one off in the other direction, trying a maneuver similar to what Hurl and I had done. That meant three ships chasing Kimmelin. Again.
"Scud," I said. "Hurl? Go. I'm almost reignited."
I hit overburn, heading back toward the main battle.
"Guys?"
Kimmelin asked.
"Guys?"
"I'm on you," FM said. "I'm on you." FM managed to chase off the ships, but another looped around to get behind her. When she went into a dodge, one of the three original ships went back on Kimmelin. Kimmelin dodged erratically, and I could imagine her panicking. She wasn't picking a strategy and sticking to it. She basically just tried every dodging pattern, one after another. I accelerated, but destructor fire flashed all around Kimmelin, and her shield crackled, taking a hit. She went in and out of overburn. I'm not going to catch her. Not in time.
"Quirk, hang on," I said over the general line. "I'm going to try something. FM, everyone, if you can disengage and follow me, try to do so. Make a regular V with me on point."
I turned toward the ship chasing FM, which was much closer to me than the ones on Kimmelin. I didn't fire, but instead swept around it in a loop, coming centimeters from the ground, sending up a cloud of dust. I then bolted upward and used my light lance to grab a small chunk of space debris. In a hard turn, I pivoted and launched it up toward Kimmelin's chaser. It passed impressively close to one of the Krell. I pulled out of my loop, and FM fell in behind me. Jorgen and Arturo broke off their engagement for a moment and did likewise.
"What is this for?" Jorgen asked over the line. "What are we doing?"
"Saving Quirk," I said. Hopefully. It depended on whether my theory was right. Tense, I turned upward and hit my overburn. For a brief moment, we held the formation. Above, the Krell chasing Kimmelin broke off and turned downward, toward me. "Cobb warned that the Krell tried to destroy our command structure," I said. "They take out flight leaders first, if they can identify them, and..." Destructor fire sprayed around me. Right. I pulled into the most complex set of dodging loops I knew, the Barrett sequence. An impressive four Krell found their way to chasing me. That protected Kimmelin, but four was more than I could handle. Each time I tried to pull upward or break away, a ship or two managed to cut me off. My Poco rattled as I spun and dodged, and destructors hit my shields. Scud, scud, scud!
"I'm coming, Spin," Hurl said. "Hang on!"
I kept dodging, destructors narrowly missing me. A part of my brain registered Arturo downing a Krell ship. How long had we been fighting? Had we really only shot down two? Where were those reinforcements?
"More ships,"
Jorgen said. "Finally," I said with a grunt as I banked.
"Not ours. Theirs."
My turn took me straight into them. Another flight of six Krell interceptors. I spun through them, and somehow avoided colliding with any.
In the chaos, I finally managed to get some altitude. My little trick must have really convinced them I was important, because three stuck on me, firing full out, as I screamed into the air.